All opinions expressed here are the views of the speaker, not necessarily those of their hosts, producers, or owners.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander. Once again, I'd like to welcome our listeners to Socialist Can, 1 hour left. And it's a weekly program that comes on every week to our listeners where we deal with various social issues from a left perspective. And when I say a left perspective, I mean from a socialist perspective. I'm not talking about those progressives that are out there that consider themselves Greens or consider themselves liberals or consider them left of the Democrats, but I'm talking about social issues from a real left perspective rooted in socialism. And today we're going to talk about some of those issues today on Socialist Can. We don't have Matt with us, but we do have Deborah and Alan Mackey joining the program today. And first, I always like to start out, Deborah, if you can just share a little bit about the program that you had on last Monday on Left of Liberal, which comes on every Monday. Could you share a little bit about the program?
Well, Daryl Rankin was on there. He's a friend of Alan's. Alan can probably tell you more about him, but we're on Monday evenings, 7 Central. It's called Left of Liberal. We have a Facebook page, Left of Liberal, with host Alan and Debbie Mackey. Look for the white peace poppy. We have a phone number, 512-517-2708, and then a email at leftofliberal@outlook.com. Do you want to say something about Daryl?
Well, in the last program, we talked about the situation in Sudan, and the people in Sudan are rising up and demanding a democratic government, and they're calling their most recent protest a revolutionary escalation, and a lot of people have been shot and beat up and jailed in this rebellion. So, you know, Daryl's been very involved in organizing solidarity with the people of Sudan. He works out of Winnipeg, and it was an interesting program. He gave us a background of the situation in Sudan, the history of Sudan and whatnot.
Well, and Deborah, could you just mention once again what time people can tune into Left of Liberal every Monday?
It's at 7 p.m. Central in the evening.
Well, today our program is going to be a little bit different from our regular program. We're taking some tidbits from each member of the panel where we're discussing several subjects today. Usually we delve into one topic and then we explore that and we go around the table where we can discuss it in more detail. Today we're taking we'll be discussing information that Deborah would like the panel to explore, also Alan Mackey and myself. Myself, I'm going to be bringing to the discussion talking about this lame duck Congress that we have in Washington and what we need to do to make some changes there. Deborah, she's going to get into and share with us information, and I should say share within the group, the conversation here, the three types of socialism. And just a recent, some information was put on tape and on the internet by Richard Wolff. He's a socialist economist, and we're going to share that. And Alan is going to be sharing some of the things that's going on in regards to some of these candidates that are calling themselves progressive Democrats and what they do not have to offer. So, Deborah, we're going to get first into the subject matter that you brought to the panel today, talking about the three types of socialism. Now, when people think of socialism, for the most part, if people call themselves socialists or say they believe in socialism, or they you know, if you call yourself a Democrat, sometimes they say, yeah, all you socialists are the same. But for the most part, a lot of people don't have a clear understanding about what socialism is. So that's, we're going to talk about Deborah's subject that she's bringing to the panel first. Alan, I would like to ask you, could you give us a clear definition, if there's any clear definition, of what socialism is?
Well, I think Albert Einstein gave a good definition of socialism way back in the late 1940s. Essentially, what Einstein said is socialism involves the public ownership of the mines, the mills, the factories, the banking, communication, and energy industries, and transportation. And without the public ownership, you really don't have socialism, in my opinion. Some people disagree. Bernie Sanders would disagree with that. But I think that's the key. Working people work in these mines, mills, and factories, and they work for capitalists, and these capitalists pay them wages. But the capitalist continues to own what these workers produce. And this is the way the capitalists make their profits. And this is where exploitation takes place. This, you know, in a capsule, this is what socialism is all about, stopping exploitation by bringing the mines and mills and the factories and whatnot under public ownership, where the people own everything and make the decisions rather than the capitalists. Right now, the Wall Street people, the big money people are making all the decisions in our society. They make the decisions about how we live, how we work, and they make all the decisions. We're totally, as working people, totally excluded from that. And in essence, socialism is all about workers' power. In other words, workers would replace the people that presently own the mines and the mills and the factories. That this workers' government would have control over those things.
So, Deborah, what we looked at on that, the information that you shared that I looked into were Richard Wolff was talking about the three different types of socialism. Deborah, was Richard Wolff saying that there's only one type of socialism, or are there more than one type of socialism?
Well, he's saying, of course, he's saying there's three, but I don't think everybody would agree with him. Probably you and Alan may not. But the first kind that he mentions is the Bernie Sanders kind, which is the where the government regulates with the capitalist economy, and the capitalist profits from it. The examples are Finland, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and it's all market controlled. The second kind is where the socialist government owns where the mine owns and runs the mines, the mills, and the factories, and they're owned and run by the government. And examples of that are the old Soviet Union, China, Cuba, and it's not so market controlled. The third kind that he mentions is where the workers or the unions own and run where they work. There's actually no country exists for the example of the third kind. With that third kind, I was questioning Alan, well, what do they do to the people who don't work, you know? How are they included in that? But Alan can give you his idea on that.
Well, one of the things I look at, and I'm going to get to Alan on that, about people that don't work, because that comes to me from time to time. But right now, 25% of the U.S. society, they prefer socialism in some parts of their life by various recent studies. But if you go and ask that 25%, you know, we want to have we should have socialism as it was in the Soviet Union. I think that's, that 25% will probably quickly go down to 1 or 2%, a lot because of just the way people have the negative thinking about the way the socialists, the USSR was being operated. And, of course, you can have problems with any system, but the main problem that we perceive here on in the Western Hemisphere was much of the propaganda that we were getting out of Washington and that we were getting from the global capitalists, because they were doing everything they could to make certain that that socialism, that type of socialism, did not work. And we can see the same thing. What has gone on with U.S. imperialism over the years? If you don't come under the global global rule of the global capitalists, they would do everything they can to make certain that the system does not work. Case in point, we can see with Venezuela, we can see that they have vast resources where the people should be able to thrive on the resources that they have within that country. But we have done everything we can to make certain that that socialist regime there does not work. Same thing in Cuba. We did everything that we could to make certain that that did not work. Same thing that we could see in North Korea and other parts of the world where it's anything outside of what the global capitalists want, they will do everything they can to make it not work. But Ellen, what is your thoughts on in the workplace? Has it ever worked, that form of democracy, as Richard Wolff had pointed out, where you have workplace democracy in the workplace?
I've never been to any socialist country, so I'm not speaking from personal experience, but I do have friends
Personal experience. I haven't either.
But I do have friends that went to the Soviet Union and were there for extended periods of time. One of my friends was Nathan Sharp, who worked in a steel mill in Chicago. And when he visited the Soviet Union, they took him to a lot of places, and he says, this is really nice here. But he says, I'd like to see a steel mill. Like, he says, I worked in a steel mill in Chicago, and I'd like to see one of your steel mills here, how people work. So they took him to a steel mill, and he said he couldn't believe what was happening. He said for every job, they had two or three workers there on the factory on the floor. And if somebody got tired, they just came and sat down, and somebody else would go take their place. And if they got tired, they'd come back and sit down. And he says there were people sitting around playing cards and reading books and just sleeping and everything. And when somebody got tired, they came and somebody else would replace them. He says, I sort of don't believe that this is happening. He says, I've never seen a workplace like this in my life. He says, can I see an auto plant? So they took him to this huge auto plant, and he said it was the same thing. He said there were benches and chairs and sofas all around the outer skirts of the factory, and it was the same thing. They had two or three people for every job, and when somebody got tired, somebody else would go take their place, and they'd come and sit down or go have coffee or tea or whatever. And he said he never saw anything like it, and because his experience was totally different. He worked 8 or 10 hours a day in the steel mill, and he was lucky to get a 15-minute break in the morning and a half-hour break for lunch and another 15 break in the afternoon. And workers in the socialist countries, especially the Soviet Union, they had a lot of power. I think Richard Wolff was a little confused when he makes the separation between his number two and number three, where he says one is government and the other is worker-owned. It's almost impossible.
Right.
You know, think about it. It's almost impossible for workers in any country, no matter how small, let alone a huge country like the United States, without taking power out of the hands of the capitalist and establishing political and economic power, working class power over the and eliminating capitalism and the capitalist power. It's almost impossible for workers to have democracy in the workplace without doing that. You can't separate the two. And I think that's where he's wrong. There's probably there's lots of different ideas about socialism. And I think one of the problems is here in this country, it's a large country. We've had so much anti-communist and anti-socialist propaganda for so many years. It's confused a lot of people. But yeah, you know, I've worked in factories and I've worked at all kinds of jobs in my life. And no matter what job I worked with, there was always at least sympathy, if not support, for socialism among the workers. A lot of workers won't speak their minds because they're afraid of being fired. And, you know, people say, well, Bernie Sanders has revived, you know, socialism, thinking about socialism. He has contributed to that. But among working people, socialist thinking has always been there because the struggles of the people over the years, the struggles to organize unions, the struggles for civil rights, the struggles for peace. If you look at any of these movements, they have all been led by socialists and communists. We never would have had a New Deal without socialists and communists advocating for working people and organizing working people to take action. And that consciousness, it remains in families. People remember that. And so, you know, it's not that all of a sudden we have this socialist interest in socialism. It's always been there. It's just been severely repressed by the government. I mean, when you got these red squads, the FBI has red squads in almost every major city. And when people start talking about socialism or peace or civil rights, right away there's a cop there ready to look and investigate you to find out who you are and who you're associating with and everything else. And so that's put a damper on socialist thinking. But the other thing is that so many people come from different perspectives. Their life experiences are different, so they have a little different perception of what socialism should look like. And I think it's healthy to have a big discussion about what socialism really is.
What about the question that Deborah had about what about the people that don't, correct me if I'm wrong, Deborah, the people that don't want to work? Was that what you said, Deborah?
Well, or, you know, or retired or don't work. Yeah.
I understand retired, because usually when you retire, like, you know, I have paid into retirement funds, like you pay into Social Security, monies that you collect go toward Medicare, you know, over your lifetime. But I think you mentioned about people that, because there's some people that just, the question always come up when people talk about socialism, and they say people want a handout, which I disagree with that. But they say, well, what about the person that just don't want to work? Don't want to contribute to society. Don't want to contribute in the workplace. How do you deal? How would that be dealt with, Alan?
There are these people that don't want to work. We usually call them capitalists. They have everybody else doing the work for them. And the only solution.
How's it going? Okay.
In that case, is, you know, to put these people to work in the places where they've been exploiting workers. If they've been exploiting people and workers in the coal mines, put them to work in the coal mines. If they've been exploiting people in the auto industry, put them to work in the auto plants, you know, and whatnot. This is the way to handle that situation. But on the other hand, you know, we're in a situation, I know I've heard Cindy Sheehan talk about this a lot. We're in a situation in this country, especially where productivity is so high. I think, you know, we're at a point where people can choose not to work, and we should be talking about some kind of living basic income. But as a general rule, I think most people want to work. I don't know too many people that don't want to work. Most people that don't work because they can't find a job or they've been fired or whatnot, but they want to work. And I think that that's just sort of a natural thing that, you know, human beings want to contribute to their community and they want to be productive. And, you know, if I don't work at all, I get sort of bored. But that there's a difference between not wanting to work and not being able to work. And then, like I say, the people that really don't want to work are the capitalists that want everybody else to do the work for them, and they make the profits and live off of the labor of others, you know. And those people we got to deal with. We got to take away their wealth. We shouldn't be shy about that. We got to take away their wealth and start using that wealth, because that wealth has been created by working people through our labor. And we got to put that wealth to work, you know, creating social programs that people need for schools, for housing, for health care, and all this. And I think one of the main things that we really have to look at, you know, when we talk about what kind of socialists there are, we maybe have to look at how these different people with different views towards socialism talk about resolving the problems that we have. If we look at Bernie Sanders and his health care program, it's a total farce and fiasco. It's an election gimmick, his Medicare for All. Anybody that's on Medicare knows that it's become a very lousy and rotten system. And as a socialist,
right.
You know, he was challenged by Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz asked him in a debate, tell us what a socialist health care system would look like. Bernie Sanders hemmed and hawed, and he never answered him. Well, if Ted Cruz would have asked me what a socialist health care system looked like, I would have told him that a socialist health care would be publicly funded and financed, publicly administered, and publicly delivered. In other words, it would operate just like our public school system. People always ask, well, what works under socialism? And, you know, the public education system works. You know, our roads, people drive down. I hear people argue against socialism, and yet they drive down the public streets and think nothing of it, you know, every single day. And in a socialist society, they expand these social programs. Look at China. People can say whatever they want about socialism in China, but I just heard Mike Gravel talk about it on the Jimmy Dore show, and he explained that China has brought 600 million people out of poverty in 30 years. This has never been done in human history. You know, no capitalist country has ever brought that many people out of poverty, just the opposite. In a capitalist country, poverty is the norm. Here in this country, according to Reverend Barber, who leads the Poor People's Campaign, he says 140 million people live at or near poverty in this country, 43% of the population. This is a disgrace. You know, here we are, the richest country in the world. The socialists would handle this problem by bringing the mines and the mills and factories under public ownership, and instead of the profits going to private capitalists, those profits would be used for the social good of society. This is the difference, you know, between, you know, Sanders, who wants to just regulate capitalism, and real socialist, in my opinion. And, you know, we got to begin to consider that. Public ownership is the key.
I was looking up a definition, and it's kind of hard when difficult when you look at what Bernie Sanders, he doesn't really call himself a socialist. He called himself a democratic socialist, and he believes
right.
in democratic socialism. And I was looking up the definition under Wikipedia for democratic socialism. It says democratic socialism is defined as having a social economy in which the means of production are socially and collectively owned or controlled alongside a democratic political system of government. Now, when Bernie Sanders calls himself a democratic socialist, I don't think he really goes by that definition, because Bernie Sanders, it sounds like he's referring to, sounds like he is saying the system is okay, we just need to make certain that we can improve the standard of living for people living in this society, with better reforms for education, better reforms for healthcare, better reforms for transportation, our infrastructure, and redirecting our wealth. But in essence, he really doesn't clearly define how that would be accomplished, and I find it very difficult to say that you're a democratic socialist when you sign on to every military spending bill that's going to go more money from war. And any socialist, we don't believe in more war. We believe in less war, 50% down to 10%, and using those funds to take care of the social needs of society. So when I was listening to Richard Wolff, I didn't get really any clarity on the three different types of socialism. And myself, for years, I believe that socialism, you know, is going to be a system where workers within a community, you know, take control of their neighborhoods, their local governments, and the productions and distribution of all the resources and goods and services within that society. I believe that they need to be in control of that. It needs to be a democratic process, where right now we don't have a democratic process in our communities, our cities, our counties, our state government, our federal government, the people that we have in charge right now are only representing the capitalists on Wall Street. They don't represent the interests of the working people. Another thing that I was listening to Richard Wolff, which he brought up, was that socialism has basically been around for 150 years. But socialism, the ideas behind socialism, what I talk about today, what I've talked about for the last 30 years, the ideas of socialism and for a socialist change in within society goes back thousands of years, not just 150 years, because you had that during the time 2,000 years ago when Jesus Christ was here, you know, talking about some of the same things that we talk about today. We had it during the same period of time during the Egyptians. And any type of society where there was a production, when there was a distribution of wealth in society and how that wealth would be distributed, we have seen that over the ages. So that 150 years sort of caught me, off guard that, you know, Richard Wolff was saying that it's only been around for 150 years. What was your thinking on that, Alan?
You know, I found that a little strange, too. I think he was trying to oversimplify, maybe. I'm not sure. I know I had a good friend, Oscar Laughlin. He served in the Manitoba provincial government as a member of the legislature there. And he was native from northern Manitoba. And we got to talking about socialism. And he says, well, I'm a socialist. And he says, I'll tell you, he says, Native people invented socialism way before Karl Marx. He says, we were living in a communal and socialist society a long time before that. He says, you know, I read Marx, and Marx talked about Native communities, and he did. And he used that as one of his examples of how people can live in harmony with nature and among themselves. And, you know, we too often we don't want to go back and look at history that far back. And, you know, I think that Richard Wolff has oversimplified probably for his program. I don't know. But I think the other tendency that he has is to oversimplify what socialism is. And, you know, unless there's a broad discussion in this country, like what was taking place at the end of World War II, there was a huge discussion about what kind of socialism people wanted, and it was essentially, you know, about working class power. That's what the talk of socialism was about. And Bernie Sanders and these people, you know, they're the Democratic Socialist. If you know, talk with these people and get to know them, they're mostly professional people and professors and whatnot, upper middle class people, and they really don't understand what working people go through day in and day out in order to survive. So, and they've got no concept of why workers might want working class power, rather than just allow, you know, elections every few years, and if the capitalists get back, that's okay, and if the socialists win election, you know, once every 20 years, that's okay too. And you know, but that's not what socialism and socialist revolution is all about. Socialist revolution is about getting rid of capitalism and establishing, you know, real democracy where workers participate fully in the economy and the politics and of the country and decide what we need to live better lives. That's what socialism is all about. You know, socialism is about the politics and economics of livelihood. That's how I explain it to people. I tell people, if you want to know what I stand for as a socialist, read the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This is what we socialists want. The problem is the liberals that created the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights left it as mere words on a piece of paper with no way to enforce it. We as socialists, we're going to enforce that through working class power, through workers taking over the mines and the mills and the factories and establishing a government that's led by working people, where the decisions are made by working people, and where the profits, instead of going to the capitalists, are used to solve the problems of the people. It's as simple as that. one of the biggest swindles taking place and the biggest transfers of wealth comes in the military from the military industrial complex. The wars and the military spending, that's the largest transfer of wealth that we have from the poor to the rich. And, you know, these people, the democratic socialists, don't even hardly want to talk about that. They'll mention it once in a while just so they can say, yes, we mentioned it. But they're not really explaining what is happening, the whole process of how this is a massive transfer of wealth from the poorest to the very wealthiest who make the profits from militarism and war. And that's got to be explained to the people. That's the nature of, you know, capitalist society at this point of imperialism. And they don't even use the term imperialism. They don't even acknowledge that capitalism has taken on a new aspect, the state monopoly capitalism in the imperialist stage of its development. They don't even want to acknowledge that. And,
well, Alan, I'm going to take a very quick pause here. I just would like to thank our listeners for joining once again to Socialist Can, 1 hour left. It's a weekly program where we discuss various social issues from a left perspective. And today we're discussing various topics from our panelists where we're going to be talking about the present lame Congress that we have in Congress, the various types of socialism, and also why various progressive Democrats haven't taken any concrete actions to do anything or accomplish anything in Washington. Well, right now, I'd like for Deborah just to take around a minute just to talk about our upcoming conference that we have coming that we will be having in Austin, Texas. And Deborah, could you share with our listeners about this upcoming event?
Yeah, I made the event on the Socialist Can page. It'll be the first thing that you come to on the page. It's August 10th. It'll be all day long. We have a location, and it's all mentioned in the comments. There's a list of hotels in the area, too. But plan on joining us. It'll be an all day from 8 to 5 or 6 in the evening.
Eight to six in the evening.
Yeah, okay. So just plan on joining us and let us know if you plan on coming so we know how many people to expect to.
It's going to be at the Live Oak Unitarian Church.
The Live Oak Unitarian Church, and that's in the downtown area of Austin, correct?
No, it's west of the downtown area.
Oh,
I'm glad
I have a Google map. I would have been lost already.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually, I think the address is actually Cedar Park, which is, I guess that's kind of northwest of the Austin area.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that announcement. We're going to move on. Next, we're going to be talking about a subject that Alan wanted to bring to the table, and he said his concern is why Bernie Sanders and these progressive Democrats haven't taken a concrete step as a first action on the question of student loans and debts. Alan, why don't you share with us your concerns in that regards?
Yeah, my concern has been that all this talk about student debt, it's approaching, I think, almost $2 trillion, somewhere between $1.4 trillion
as of right now.
Yeah, and all these politicians are talking about that they're going to cancel the debt and everything. Bernie Sanders says he's going to cancel the debt, and Elizabeth Warren says she's going to cancel some of the debt. But they're using this as an election gimmick, in my opinion. In my opinion, they don't intend to do anything, just like they don't intend to do anything else to resolve the problems of the working people. And when it comes to student debt, there's these collection agencies that they're sending after people that owe on these loans for student loans. They're taking all kinds of action, including garnishing people's wages, people make at poverty wage jobs. I know people that are making $7.50 and $8 an hour that their wages are being garnished. people on Social Security that are getting anywhere from $600 to $800 a month, $900. If you make over, I think it's over $750 or something on Social Security, they can garnish your Social Security payments. And, you know, this is terrible. And if the Democrats were serious about this, the thing is, we got to realize that many of the Trump supporters, people who Trump claims as his supporters anyways, these are people that have lived in the Rust Belt in the Midwest and the farms, who they've lost their homes, they've lost their farms, they've lost their cars, and yet the debt collectors are still coming after them for these student loans. You know, we got a large segment of the American people that can be mobilized behind a very simple demand, and that is to stop these garnishments. And this could be done very easily by Congress.
And Deborah, what is your take on that? Deborah? Alan?
Hello?
Maybe everybody dropped you.
Try getting
Hello?
Dan on there.
Yeah, yep. There you are. Is Stuart on here?
Yes, I hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, he was dropped, but he's back. I don't know what happened. Okay, everybody's on now.
Yeah, the line went complete. You know, it's those damn capitalists.
Yeah. I'm telling you, I heard that, you know, the three sounds, the three da-da-da, and you were all gone. So I had to call back in, and, okay, you're all on. So
Alan, you and I can remember those days when you start talking about taking the money back, all of a sudden the line went black. So
That may be what happened here.
Right. So These are some steps that Congress could actually take that could easily go through should easily go through the House and the Senate. But this topic is not even coming up on the floor of the House and the Senate.
Let me just explain for a minute, Stuart. You know, we have a situation, Joe Biden. He is one of the people that made it so students cannot declare bankruptcy to get out of their student loans. And he did this for over a number of years. He kept making the law more stringent and more stringent over a period of time. And on top of that, we had Obama, who one of his biggest backers came from Xerox Corporation. And the Xerox Corporation owned Affiliated Computer Services, which was one of the largest student debt collectors in the United States. And they worked out of a call center in Jamaica where they paid people practically nothing to harass people to try and collect on these loans. And then on top of that, they sold much of these student loans, the debts, they sold them to Deutsche Bank, a German bank with ties to the Nazis. And relatives of Nazis, they're still in control of the Deutsche Bank. And they started pressing students even more and more for these student loan
and garnishing the wages. And then on top of that, we have Betsy DeVos, who's the education secretary, who has investments with Performant Financial Company, who was another student loan debt collector using garnishments and garnishing the wages of poor working people and people on Social Security. So you have this whole, bunch of people that are profiting off of these student loan debt collections, and they charge enormous amounts for the collection costs, and then they increase the interest. The government, on top of the interest payments, which were low, like 2% when people first got these loans, now they're up 4, 5, and 6%. So people that maybe, if you went to a community college and you maybe owed $12,000, now you owe $16,000, $18,000, $20,000. And on top of that, you know, you have a job that's paying you minimum wage or $8 or $9 an hour. And then they come over after you and they want to take, 30% of your pay. And they don't take that 30% based on your take-home pay. They take the 30% right off the top of your gross pay.
Exactly.
So, you know, this is a terrible situation that literally hundreds of thousands of people in this country are in default on their student loans because of this, because there's no way they'll ever be able to pay these loans back. And the bankers have made big profits, and they've used politicians like Joe Biden to enable this. So,
steps could be taken by Congress right now, Alan?
So the concrete step that can be taken is to reverse this legislation that says that students can't file for bankruptcy. And the other important step that Congress could take is to say that there will be no garnishments of people's wages or Social Security. After all, even the maximum Social Security payment is only $2,700 a month. You know, and if you take 30% of that, you're taking a lot out of somebody's income. Myself, I get $190 a month, and they want to take money from me. They've been after me for years, and there's many people I've talked to that are in the same position, and that they will keep coming after people until the day they die. And when they die, they'll put a lien on their home and try and take that money out of the home if it's sold. You know, so these bankers are making all kinds of money, and the government, the government is made up of politicians like Joe Biden. He's received over $19 million over his career from these very bankers that are profiting from these people being in default on their student loans. This is criminal, and this all needs to be exposed. And once exposed, the people would demand that Congress pass legislation to end these garnishments. That should be the very first step. Now, I posted this all over Facebook, and what happens? All these Democrats, the Democratic Party hacks, come in and say, "We got a solution. We're going to cancel student debt." Well, you know, they've been talking about doing this as an election gimmick for years, and they've done nothing on it. And they're not going to do anything on it unless the people that owe these debts begin to organize and say, "We're not going to pay, and we're not going to vote for people unless they stop these garnishments." It's as simple as that. They talk about incremental and baby steps all the time, these Democrats. And yet, when it comes to taking one of these incremental baby steps to solve a problem like this, they sit on their hands and do nothing. Worse than that, they do nothing. They do like Joe Biden and the rest of the Democrats and Republicans did and pass legislation that makes it so that these students will never get out from under this debt. They're guaranteeing the banks that they'll always have a source of income, a source of profits off of these student debts. This is sheer, it's robbery. It's a loan sharking, and it's being made legal is what it amounts to.
Deborah, I'm going to ask you, what is your opinion? Alan's talking about incremental steps, and I fully agree with those incremental steps that he proposed. Deborah, what is your thought about, right now we have K through 12 high school, but what if we had education where it was free nationwide, where it was the government would have it, you know, Washington, you know, through federal programs, that education would be paid at no cost to students, K through 4 years of college. I mean, as an incremental step. I believe it should be through university level, but what about just the first 4 years of college extending that? What is your idea on that as an incremental step?
Definitely, that would be a plus. A lot of countries do it, and, you know, we are
exactly
the wealthiest country in the world, and there's no reason why we can't. If we get rid of some of the unnecessary things, then there would be the money there. They always ask, well, where are you going to get the money? Well, it would be there if you get rid of, war, you know, the military
right.
industrial complex giving them trillions. So, yeah, it definitely could be done. And there's no reason why they can't.
When you consider defense spending, not military spending, but defense spending, when it's approaching $2 trillion, that's with a T, $2 trillion. When you consider the defense budget that is being approved and signed on by these Warrens and being signed on by these Sanders and signed on by these Bookers, when these defense funding bills for military funding bills for over $700 billion. I believe there is money to pay for education. But right now it's a matter of priority, and unfortunately this Congress doesn't have that as their priority. I'm going to move on to my concern that I wanted to bring to this discussion today is this lame Congress in Washington. And right now we have a problem that is totally out of control in Washington, and that problem is the U.S. Congress. Right now we have gone from a body of 535 people that's supposed to be representing the people of the 50 states to now one person in an Oval Office that is running the country. And basically this Congress is completely impotent, and we have a fascist regime now that is being run by a dictator. And some of the things that I wanted to bring to the table about the legislative branch has relegated this responsibility to the executive branch in government. Alan, what is your thought on that?
Well, I agree completely. The Congress is letting Trump do just what he wants to do in every single situation. And they're hiding.
Alan, let me ask you, is Congress doing this because they're doing it due to the dictates of Wall Street? Because it's easier for Wall Street to tell one person what to do rather than tell 535 people what to do and agree on change. What do you think about, because now it's from 1 to 535 to one person running Washington.
Yeah, I think that Wall Street wants to, you know, streamline government to suit its needs, and Trump is serving that purpose, and he's serving their purposes very well. Congress has no say. It doesn't assert itself when it comes to issues of war and peace. It doesn't assert itself when it comes to Social Security or anything else, in defending Social Security and the social programs. Congress is totally useless at this point. The Democrats are harping on this issue of Russiagate, which is a myth. It doesn't even exist, when they should be focusing on the issues. Trump has used executive orders to destroy our air and waters. And the land, he's used executive order privileges to allow the contamination of, you know, our water. We've got the situation in Flint and in communities all across this country, actually, where the water is contaminated and unfit for drinking. It used to be that you could drink water from any tap and it would be healthy water. And, Congress has completely just abdicated its responsibility and acquiesced and done nothing. And I don't think it's by accident. I think it's the Wall Street lobbyists and the the people from Wall Street that fund their campaigns that are pulling the strings and telling them to sit by and allow Trump to do this.
Whenever people see that name, Washington, D.C., they need to think of two things. It's all about Wall Street, and Washington, D.C. is Washington, divide and conquer. Because Wall Street, that's what they have done. They have divided all of the levels of government, and now they have one person, which is the CEO, functioning for Wall Street right out of the Oval Office. Deborah, we have, you know, when we look at what has taken place, as Alan mentioned, they just talking about this Russiagate and the Mueller report for well over a year, but Congress is extremely divided on all matters in the House and the Senate. Deborah, do you see any light at the end of the tunnel, or is it completely an abyss where there's no government, legislative branch in government that has any type of authority anymore?
No, I don't think the government is going to do anything. The things that Trump is doing and them not responding to stop it is against our Constitution. The stuff he does, if you study or look into what Hitler did and how he took control, it's leading up. He's doing the same thing. And he has people that come to his rallies and just cheer him on, thousands and thousands of people. And more are coming. And, you know, what's making these people come to him? I don't understand. And the only solution is people standing up and saying, no, this is not going to happen.
Well, Alan, you mention all the time that we need to have, workers where we organize and have a labor, have a working class party. Alan, it seems to me that that's the only way that we're going to have any accountability in Washington, because right now we don't have no accountability because we don't have that working class party. We don't have the leadership that's representing the workers within our various states. But Alan, is that the solution, that we need to organize on the left and have representatives to speak for the working class and to speak for what our agenda should be in Washington, rather than what the capitalist agenda is?
Well, I think it's part of the solution to have a working class based people's party. That's part of the solution. The other another big part of the solution is we got to develop huge mass movements around fighting for solutions to our very real and specific problems. And those movements and coalitions have to coalesce into this working class based people's party. That's the way I see things happening as far as if we're going to make any headway.
But how do we prevent how do we prevent the Democrats from taking their traditional role where they absorb any type of progressive movement or people's action? Because that has been their role for almost 100 years now.
Well, I don't think we're going to be able to stop the Democrats from continuing to be Democrats. I think that there are some Democrats, especially people at the grassroots level. I know I've worked with people in the Democratic Party for years, and most people that start working in the Democratic Party get fed up with it because they can't make any headway. And this, especially for working people, when they bring their problems into the Democratic Party, the people, the Democratic Party hacks poo-poo their problems, and they get frustrated, and they just leave the Democratic Party. So, you don't find too many grassroots activists and trade unionists and working class people staying in the Democratic Party very long if they're really seeking solutions to their problems. I think this whole idea that's been brought forward by Reverend Barber and a number of other people in the Poor People's Campaign is also a very good initiative. I've been reading their program, and I watched some of their stuff on YouTube at their recent conference, and I think they're making a lot of headway in organizing poor people and all over the country. And I think this is the kinds of things we got to be engaged in. And unless we organize in this way, we're not going to make any headway. We can't rely on the Democrats for anything. I mean, they just can't be relied on. They're not a party of working people. They're a party of big capital, of Wall Street, just like the Republicans. And that's the interest. They look after Wall Street's interest. I mean, Obama proved that. Obama had raised high hopes among many, many millions of people that he was really going to change things. And what did he do? He appointed all these Wall Street people to all the various positions in government, not much different than what Donald Trump has done. In fact, I think he laid the foundation for Trump to come into office with the way he backtracked on everything that he had promised. So we can't rely on these Democrats. There will be some Democrats. I would like to see Bernie Sanders and people like Tulsi Gabbard get involved in helping to start a new party. And, you know, we had a progressive party at one time in this country with Henry Wallace, who had been a Democrat and left the Democratic Party to run as the presidential candidate of the Progressive Party. And there were many working people that ran for state and other federal offices on the Progressive Party ticket, and some of them did very well. It was only political
repression that stopped it. And I have one more minute here.
So, you know, I think the main thing is that people got to get together around their kitchen tables and in their church basements and union halls and begin to discuss all these things, and we got to find a way out of this mess. That's the only solution that I see.
Well, once again, I'd like to thank our listeners for joining the program today. A lot of food for thought, a lot of things that we can look at where Congress can bring about real change within the United States. And we'll be looking forward. Be certain to just click on the link if you see it on the Internet, if you see it on Facebook, and share the program. Once again, I'd like to thank Deborah Mackey, Alan Mackey, Ruth Ann, Martha Fior, and for joining the program. We look forward to having you to join us next week at the same time. Have a good night, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.